traveling the world searching for equestrians of all breeds. The journey starts now on the International Equine Network.
Of the Florida Everglades and only 10 miles from the beach, a piece of land sits within a picturesque setting as if it were itself within a movie. Palm trees and green grass present a perfect backdrop for the pink flamingos that adorn this oasis of a time gone by. In its heyday, it was described as breathtaking, remarkable, extraordinary, and one of the most beautiful racetracks in the world. It would not only become a place for the wealthiest people in the world to spend their winter months, it would also become a stop for some of the best racehorses the world would ever see. Florida's first thoroughbred horse racing track, Hialeah Park, quickly became a premier destination for horse racing enthusiasts around the world. Hialeah Park's history dates back to the early 20th century and played a significant role in the development of horse racing in Florida. Hialeah Park was opened on January 25, 1925, by aviation pioneer Glenn Curtis and his partner, Missouri cattleman James H. Bright. The track was designed by architect Lester W. Geisler, and its construction cost around $1.5 million. The track's design and features were unlike any other at the time. It featured beautiful landscaping, an ornate clubhouse, and a stunning flamingo-shaped fountain in the infield. Hialeah Park's Spanish-style architecture and lush gardens added to its charm, making it a popular social destination as well. During the 1920s and 1930s, Hialeah Park gained a reputation for hosting prestigious horse races and attracting some of the most prominent figures in American society. Wealthy socialites, politicians, and celebrities were often seen at the track, and it became a symbol of elegance and sophistication. Notable horses such as Seabiscuit and Citation raced at Hialeah Park, adding to its prestige. In 1929, Hialeah Park introduced the Florida Derby, a race for three-year-old thoroughbreds. The name of the race would later change to the Flamingo Stakes in 1937. The Flamingo quickly became one of the most important races for Kentucky Derby contenders, and its winners often went to achieve success in the Triple Crown races. Nine of the Flamingo winners went on to win the Kentucky Derby, and two of them, Citation and Seattle Slough, would go on to win the Triple Crown itself. Hialeah Park continued to flourish throughout the 1940s and 1950s, hosting renowned races and attracting large crowds. One of the least heralded but historically important runners at Hialeah was a three-year-old named Bridled and Bit. Running in a simple claiming race, thousands of eyes would watch him as he made his way onto the track on February 7, 1969, with 20-year-old Diane Crump aboard. It was the first time a licensed female jockey would ride in a pari-mutuel race in the U.S., and onlookers knew it was a revolutionary moment. It was clear that most were not happy with the idea that a woman was going to be allowed to race. A security detail was deemed necessary to accompany her through the crowds from the little room she was given to change in, all the way to the saddling paddock. Ownership would change hands a few times until 1977, when it was acquired by a breeder and developer, John Brunetti. Brunetti was committed to develop and restore the legendary racetrack, which on March 2, 1979, was listed in the National Register of Historical Places. In 1974, Academy Award-winning film The Godfather Part II was filmed at the historic track and would signal the way for others to use the venue. In 1978, Oscar-nominated and Golden Globe Award-winning film The Champ was filmed at Hialeah. In 1988, the movie Let It Ride was also filmed at the track.
No! The horse is probably going to swallow its tongue or something.
He's coming through!
You're the greatest I've ever seen. I'll tell my grandchildren about you.
In 2001, Hialeah Park stopped hosting thoroughbred racing after a change in Florida state law kept it from having exclusive dates in its competition with close-by Gulfstream and Calder Racecourse. Consequently, owner John Brunetti said that with the track already struggling financially, it would be unable to compete with the other tracks and closed Hialeah Park to the public. The track would sit vacant for the next few years and would even have its racing permit revoked for going multiple years without running any races. In 2009, Brunetti would apply for and be granted a quarter horse license. The historic racetrack reopened on November 28, 2009, but only for quarter horse races. The park installed slot machines in January 2010 as a part of a deal to allow for two other calendar seasons of racing. On August 14, 2013, a brand new casino opened its doors at Hialeah Park. At some point over the next few years, the track that was once known as one of the most beautiful racetracks in the world was able to take advantage of a state law that required them to hold racing. For Hialeah to run its casino, it was required to run its quarter horse racing. However, the law was very vague on what that exactly meant. When Hialeah opened for the season, they would run two race cards a day, with roughly eight races on each card, and only two horses in each race. The horses would stand in a makeshift starting gate and run 110 yards. They would do this for the minimum number of days required. It quickly became known how ridiculous this was, but it didn't seem to stop them. As of today, the casino is still in business and still simulcast races. The track sits vacant, although there are now plans for a comprehensive development that supports the rich tradition and revitalization of Hialeah Park. The complete restoration of existing amenities and buildings and the development of a new entertainment experience includes a full-service hotel, a movie theater, and the creation of an outlet shopping village. There seems to be no talk currently about bringing back thoroughbred racing or restoring the track itself.
Hi, I'm Christina Blacker. Welcome to the Del Mar Thoroughbred Club, host site for back-to-back Breeders' Cup World Championships in 2024 and in 2025. Situated on the sunny shores of the Pacific Ocean, around 20 miles north of San Diego, Del Mar is one of the world's most beautiful racetracks and has established itself as a must-visit racing destination for fans all around the globe. The Seaside Oval has hosted two previous Breeders' Cups, in 2017 and most recently in 2021, where a capacity crowd contributed to a record two-day Breeders' Cup wagering handle while witnessing the world's best horses compete for ultimate glory. The Del Mar Thoroughbred Club has one of the most storied histories of any racecourse in North America, and today we're going to take you on a behind-the-scenes tour to share some of that history as we saddle up for the 41st Breeders' Cup World Championships. The history of the Del Mar Thoroughbred Club can be traced back to the golden age of Hollywood, and one name in particular, Bing Crosby. Bing founded the course back in 1937, and his legend well and truly lives on to this day. Bing was as big a Hollywood star as they come. The singer and actor had dozens of number one hits while playing the starring role in countless blockbuster films. He was also a racing fan and a marketing guy. On opening day in 1937, Bing brought along his Hollywood buddies and invited fans to come and see the movie stars. Thousands of racegoers lined up to get a glimpse of Hollywood royalty and were personally met here at the gates by the man himself as a new history of racing got underway, right here where the turf meets the surf. Bing wrote the song, Where the Turf Meets the Surf, in honor of his love for Del Mar. It's a tune that is still embraced by the crowd before the first race, on every single race day.
Where the turf meets the surf, down at old Del Mar, take a plane, take a train, take a car.
Ever wondered why the first post at Del Mar is always 2 p.m. or later? Well, we could thank Bing for that, too. You see, he used to like entertaining his Hollywood friends in the turf club after the races, and these legendary parties would often go on until the early hours. Given he was also partial to a game of golf, the 2 p.m. race start was born and has been a tradition here at Del Mar ever since. How many of you know that the photo finish was born right here at the Del Mar Thoroughbred Club? We're at the famous diamond-patterned finish post at Del Mar, the scene of two extremely tight photo finishes back in 2021. When firstly, Aloha West edged Dr. Chival by a nose in the Qatar Racing Breeders' Cup Sprint.
Here's Aloha West flying down the center of the track. Here's the wire. Oh, it's close. Aloha West may have run down Dr. Chival at the end.
Before, Marsh Lorraine secured a historic Breeders' Cup Saturday double for Japan, holding off Dunbar Road's late rally in the Longines Distaff.
They're coming to the wire, and it is! Oh, it's desperately close! Was it Marsh Lorraine, or was it Dunbar Road in the Breeders' Cup Distaff?
It's Marsh Lorraine!
Whoa!
These days, photos of tight finishes can be produced within seconds to help stewards establish the winner. Interestingly, the history of the photo finish can be traced back to right here at the Del Mar Thoroughbred Club. You see, before Del Mar opened its doors in 1937, stewards used to rely on their eyesight and split-second judgments to determine the winner in a tight finish, which, as you could imagine, would often lead to disputes and some pretty grumpy horse players. But given Del Mar's deep roots with Hollywood, founder Bing Crosby enlisted an engineer from a movie studio called Lorenzo Del Riccio to record the finish of each race with his newly created camera, essentially inventing horse racing's photo finish. Such was the success of the photo finish, racetracks all around the country came knocking, and despite being under contract with his movie studio employer, Lorenzo had found himself quite the lucrative side hustle. He would reportedly go on to sell his camera to the racetracks for the princely sum of $300,000 each way back in the 1930s, which equates to more than $5 million per camera in today's money. Lorenzo managed to keep one step ahead of his employer as they chased him across the country, and it's rumored he eventually retired to the island of Capri. So next time your horse is involved in a photo finish, remember the innovative spirit of the early founders of Del Mar, where the photo finish was born, forever changing the world of horse racing. Side note, did you know there has only been one dead heat in the history of the Breeders' Cup? The 2003 Breeders' Cup turf at Santa Anita delivered one of the most thrilling finishes in the history of the World Championships, when three horses, Johar, High Chaparral, and Fall Brav, went head for head to the wire. There was a 13-minute stewards review of the photo before the race was declared a dead heat between Johar and High Chaparral, marking the first, and to this day, only, Breeders' Cup dead heat. Have you ever wondered how much $1 million in cash weighs? Well, let me tell you, 22 pounds. I'm deep underground in the money room at the Del Mar Thoroughbred Club. Where on a regular race day, millions of dollars will pass through these doors and get sent to the betting windows around the track before making its way back here to get counted up and sent via armored vehicles to the bank at the end of the day. During the Breeders' Cup, the millions are multiplied. Del Mar keeps $1 million cash on hand under lock and key for any big winners on race day that would prefer to take home cash rather than a check. What would you do It might be a decision for the winner of this year's Breeders' Cup Betting Challenge, one of the richest and most prestigious horse player tournaments, which offers an estimated $1.25 million in cash prizes. Does anyone need this back? One of the most iconic moments in the history of world horse racing happened right here at the Del Mar Thoroughbred Club back in 1938, when national hero Seabiscuit battled Bing Crosby's Argentinian bred Ligurati in a match race. More than 20,000 fans packed these stands at Del Mar, including Hollywood celebrities, for the showdown between the two equine titans. A pot of $25,000 was put up for grabs. That was $10,000 more than Seabiscuit's match race with War Admiral. The crowd went crazy as Seabiscuit and Ligurati were side by side, head to head down the stretch before Seabiscuit prevailed on the wire, breaking the track record by 4 seconds in the process. The race was broadcast live across the country on Bing Crosby's radio show, putting Del Mar well and truly on the map in just its second year of operation. That wraps up our behind the scenes tour from beautiful Del Mar, but I want to leave you with one last piece of trivia. The Del Mar Thoroughbred Club is the only racetrack in North America with direct access to the beach. And up until the 1980s, trainers used to walk their horses through a tunnel under the train tracks directly onto the soft sand and straight into the Pacific Ocean. For the horses, it was a refreshing break from their regular routine, and the cold water was natural therapy for their legs. It's time for me to go take a dip before the races this afternoon. We look forward to welcoming you to where the turf meets the surf for the Breeders' Cup World Championships this November.
This morning we had a couple of hands coming in early for Wayne Lucas, and you know, he's preparing for the season at Saratoga. So he shipped in 3 vans this morning, 3 vans yesterday. He's filling up quickly. We've had also a few vans for Dale Roman coming up, you know, to bring his big boy for the Travis. So hopefully we're going to be bringing more action throughout the day. You know, it's easy. These guys come out of church here, and they take a van ride for about 16 hours, you know, try to make the horses comfortable in the van as the best we can, and try to bring them here so they can compete, you know, full throttle until September, whatever it is, 6, 7, whatever, you know, Labor Day. But, you know, the idea is just try to bring them here in good shape and not too tired so they can compete right away. That's what my job is all about, is to try to give them a good ride and try to give them the best service we can. And, you know, just to make sure the horse is well taken care of at all time, that's all, you know.
Okay.
Do not bear to the right, to the left. You go straight down. There will be a chute on your right inside. You'll see, what's his name, Price is over there.
Yeah, I know where a chute is right there on the right. That's before you go around the curve there.
Right.
There's a chute right there.
Right.
All right.
It's on the other side.
All right.
You just got to readjust once in a while. You know, sometimes you have a plan and you think it's going to work out great, but, you know, something comes in the way and you just got to go around it and just make sure everything works out fine and that the horses are not being in distress or that nothing is going to go wrong for the horse. It's basically what it is. So we had to move chutes and we came to a closer chute to the barn and it all worked out fine. Horse is happy in the stalls now and everything's fine.
We left Churchill Downs last night about 7:30 p.m., heading this way. We stop every four and a half hours to water the horses, make sure that everybody's in good spirits and not in any distress or anything like that. So adds a little bit to the trip, but it's one of those things that we do just to make sure the animals are, you know, taken care of.
I started when I was young, 13 years old back in France. I wanted to be a jockey, you know, jockey's dream or whatever, and then I guess too much soup or too much water, I don't know, but I started growing too fast. But anyways, long story short, I ended up here in the United States. Worked as an assistant trainer for about 15 years, and one day I just got given the opportunity to go work for a very reputable van company, and it's not something I plan on doing, but it's something that I'm doing, and I'm trying to do it the best I can.
We pride ourselves, you know, on hiring horsemen that can drive trucks. We take hauling horses very seriously. It's important to us, so we try to hire the best people, and, you know, we have the best equipment, and It's a good situation.
So what, 90% of our employees at Sally have horsemanship, 90% of them, you know, unless they're working in the office. But the people that are actually working on the grounds and around the horses are horsemen. That's something that we take pride of. It's I think it's very important. You have to be able to adjust to situations like we talked about earlier. These are animals, if you don't know what to do around them, then it's going to be very difficult to do the right thing. You have to know this animal. I mean, these are 1,200 pound animals. There's no time to play around. When there is a situation, you have to be a horseman to know, you know, the, what it is that you have to do to make yourself safe and not sorry. They're all different, you know. It's funny. They're very much like humans. You'll have the ones that are scared of everything. You'll have the one that nothing phases whatsoever. You know, they can take a van ride, a plane ride, and it's not going to affect them whatsoever. But you have some others who, on the other hand, you know, just can't take the shipping as good. They get stressed out. It's a new environment. It's not their home, their own stall. It's a moving vehicle. It's moving vehicles around the moving vehicles. You know, so it can be very stressful for some of them. And we will see that some horses actually show signs of stress. You know, like 48 hours after a big shipment, for example, on a 24-hour shipment or whatever. There's been studies proven that after a 24-hour period, a horse can actually spike a fever and all that. All due to stress. It's all related to stress. So, like I said, my job. Try to keep them as stress-free as possible. That's the idea.
Why don't you, once you get on the tack off right here?
See, the thing in my ear is really great help because I can multitask, you know what I mean? Obviously, I like to be hands-on, so you have to be able to communicate with the trainers when they, you know, when they want to tell you when they want to go and how they want to do it, so I have to be able to communicate with them. So I'd say a big part of my day is on the phone, a lot of time on the phone. But also you have to be able to be on the ground and socialize with everybody. So you have to try to get, you know, your trucks in early in the morning and try to get them out early in the morning because it's cooler. And then after that, you can organize yourself and go talk to the trainers and whatnot. So basically do your groundwork. And after that, it's just to try to keep everything organized for the shipment, and, you know, during the rest of the morning and basically, yeah, organizing. That's all.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Let me know.
This is interesting because, as you've seen, it's always different. It's always changing. And a lot of guys that haul freight, you know, they bump docks, so to speak. They'll haul freight from one place to another place. They'll back into the dock. They'll offload them, load them, and there they go. What we do, it's different in that we get to deal with animals. We get to get out there and see, you know, really unique and beautiful places such as Saratoga Springs, New York. So it's ever-changing, and it's refreshing.
The one thing that I'm going to say is I am dedicated. The whole company is dedicated to the racehorse. And I firmly believe that if I can give the best service for the horse, the trainer is going to be happy, and that's the only way it goes. If the horse is happy, the trainer is happy, I'm happy. That's where my life, you know, that's where basically it revolves around. Just try to keep them happy. And but super agent, no, I just try to do the job that I'm has to do the best I can. And like I said, with them in mind first, you know.
Welcome to Racing Education, a series that aims to open the doors on the incredible sport of horse racing. Join us as we get behind the scenes and take to the skies to find out how and why horses fly. We head stateside to the Breeders' Cup with the Platinum Queen and Midnight Mile as they take on the Americans at the World Championships.
Strange environment to put horses in at airports. You go business class, economy, it's the same as people.
You know, in horse racing as a trainer, you'd hope one day you might be lucky enough to have a horse to run the Breeders' Cup.
It's the elite of the elite.
What is it that makes the Breeders' Cup so special to you?
It's just an all-star race for horses, so you get the best from all around the world. Most of the races, any horse can win.
Well, the atmosphere on a Breeders' Cup day is tremendous. You get people from all walks of life roaming around in the crowd, very colourful characters, and to win a Breeders' Cup race will live long in the memories of anyone who can do it.
Find out how they fly the thousands of miles to the USA and the work that goes into preparing a horse for a long-haul flight and elite international competition.
Just hoping now everything runs smoothly for the plane and over there, and she takes it all in her stride.
So our journey begins here at the yard of Richard Fahey, and this is the Platinum Queen, one of the yard's big hopes for the Breeders' Cup 2022.
and we're going to check out some of the work she's doing before she flies over to Kentucky. And we're going to speak to some of the people that look after her and put the work into looking after horses like the Platinum Queen and Midnight Mile before they take on a big journey overseas. So, Erin, we're here with Midnight Mile on the day she flies to Kentucky. What are your hopes for the Breeders' Cup?
We're hoping for a big run from her. You'll be her first time in an aeroplane. She'd be fantastic. And her temperament is phenomenal, so it's all pluses. So just want to get out there now and get on with it.
So this is the Platinum Queen, one of Richard Fahey's big prospects over in Keeneland at the Breeders' Cup 2022. She's just doing some of her final prep work before she flies off to Kentucky later this afternoon. And you might be wondering, do horses have luggage like human beings? Horses need things, you know, they've got requirements when they go wherever they need to go. And the answer is yes. I'm joined by Catherine here at Richard Fahey's to find out more information on what goes in to taking a horse abroad.
It kind of starts about 2 months before. They need bloods done to be able to travel. They need obviously their passports and customs documents. They all kind of take quite a while.
There's a period of quarantine involved when you arrive in America. What sort of preparation do you have to do for that?
Not a lot, really. They're going to arrive there on the Saturday and they quarantine Sunday, Monday, and they get released on the Tuesday.
There's no horse in the country can't travel with its own passport. They're quite self-explanatory. The age, the sex, the species, and then you have its unique life number, which is microchip number. And then you go a few pages in and it's got its markings. Sometimes a chip, so you can't get mixed up because there's been a few cases. And then you obviously with all the vaccinations stamped and signed with our vet. One of the most important things, the horse can't run without it.
Do you have to do things like check in the horse's luggage and things like that?
Yeah, so they send it the day before to the airport so they can check it that there's nothing in it that you can't have in it, and then we're good to go.
So we're here in a bed fit for a queen, the Platinum Queen. She's just done her final bits of work before she flies over to Kentucky later this afternoon. And Erin, is she ready for America?
Yeah, definitely. We can't wait now to get over and see her perform. There's been a lot of work behind the scenes, not only just for the horse, but for Joel Thomas, our head travelling lad. He's had to organise a lot, and Catherine in the office to book and plan. Especially when we've got two live contenders going across, you don't leave anything for chance in the sense of what you bring in the medical side and also for the horse and obviously the riding side for us. So the last sort of weeks just have been a little bit stressful just to make sure everything's fine. Okay. And we've got everything. And hopefully she can relax in the plane and have a good ride over.
So then, we've got a rough idea of how much hard work and preparation goes into sending racehorses to far-flung destinations around the world. The next time we see the Platinum Queen and Midnight Mile will be in Kentucky for the Breeders' Cup, where we're going to speak to the owners and trainers about why. Why send racehorses thousands of miles around the world to run a race? We're also going to take in some of the incredible atmosphere at Keeneland for the Breeders' Cup 2022. In fact, if I click my fingers, we could be there in a second. And just like that, here I am. Keeneland Racetrack in Kentucky for the Breeders' Cup 2022. Let's go and see how the horses we followed are getting on. I'm delighted to be joined by Brian from LG Bloodstock, who's going to shed some light for us on what happens when a horse gets on an aeroplane. Basically, how do horses fly?
You go business class, economy, just like an ordinary.
For horses?
Budget. Yeah, exactly the same. So you'd have one, first class would be a horse on his own.
How do the horses react to flying then? Because it's got to be unusual for them. They don't really understand what's going on.
I would say about 90-95% of them are fine. We earn our money when it's the 5%, but okay. Our main job is to get them on the aircraft. We load them into the stalls and then they're lifted up and they're put into a cargo aircraft. They stand all the way, they're fed, they're watered, you can control the temperature. We can go back and check the horses at any time.
Does the pilot have to behave differently, drive the plane differently?
Depends on the size of the aircraft and depends on the length of the runway, but if we can get a nice rolling start when we land, not hitting the brakes too much, they're generally pretty good.
Platinum Queen.
So they've landed in Kentucky and it's time for some rest, so they'll head to quarantine for 48 hours before the action really begins.
You're seeing her on the Platinum Queen. Midnight Mile. And leading now. In quarantine, so we're limited to do the next 48 hours. And get an hour in the morning. Not in the evening. I'm taking it very well.
So, Richard, how are the Phillies?
Travelled well, eating well, drinking well. We haven't done much with them since they've come, just like Cantors. Both Phillies seem to be in a good place, so fingers crossed they've travelled well, and we're very pleased where we are with them.
Yeah, look, she's in great form, and we went on the grass today, which was something different for her, but look, she's in great form, and look, it's only a couple of days to the race, but hopefully we can keep her in one piece till then.
Obviously, we know how much time goes into making these horses ready for track, for prepping them, coming over to fly. We spent time with Erin and Midnight Mile at Richard Fahey's yard, and it all comes down to this, just a few minutes. Let's see what happens. Here we go then, this is it, the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Turf Sprint. All eyes, for us at least, on the Platinum Queen.
They're off for the Juvenile Turf Sprint.
And they're off, here we go.
Oxymore had a good beginning. Love Rains.
Not a bad start,
inside.
You know.
Speed Boat Beaches right there.
Roughly fourth at the moment, early on, down the first straight. Platinum Queen, she's dropping back a little.
Here comes Mr. Magic, and Mr. Magic, and William Buick do it!
I guess that's just the way it works out sometimes. It's a valiant effort from the Platinum Queen. Dramatised as well, doing exceptionally well there. It's just like we saw in the first episode of Racing Education. Dreams are often made or lost in events like this. And she put in a valiant effort. Incredible. Well, that's just the way it is.
Parabel and Marazzi Anna, these two with creative force, closing in the middle. It is going to be Parabel to win the turf sprint.
You can't be anything but delighted. The horse has run a stormer. For a split second, I thought we had it, but you know, fair play to the winner. Obviously, as games have come, but yeah, I mean, listen, when you've got Ryan on board, that's an added bonus. You know, the last 50 yards, obviously, the filly was very game.
Now let's see how Midnight Mile gets on in the Juvenile Fillies Turf.
They're off in the Juvenile Fillies Turf. Free look, Comanche Country, right at the rail, Be Your Best alongside, a Tate, Teacher to the outside, Midnight Mile, and Laston, all finishing down the middle of the court, but it will be Meditate. Oh, she just dominated the Juvenile Fillies Turf. pleasant passage with second.
So probably not the result the Fahey team would have wanted on the day. A valiant effort from Midnight Mile coming from the back to finish in fourth. And the Phantom Queen ugly disappointing, but she owes them absolutely nothing. It's not a loss for the Europeans, though. Charlie Appleby's incredible record at the Breeders' Cup continues. And in the final race of the day, and a win for Aidan O'Brien, Victoria Road brought home victory under Ryan Moore. And that was two victories for Ryan Moore on the day as well. So not all bad for the Europeans at the Breeders' Cup. You can watch more Sporting Life video by clicking on the left here. And you can download the free Sporting Life app in your app store now for the latest news, expert tipping insight and big race analysis all at the tap of a finger. Users must be 18 or over to sign up to the Sporting Life app.
This is Al Fritsch at earthhealing.info. Today we're going to invite you to come and visit the Old Friends, a thoroughbred retirement facility located off of Interstate 64 near Lexington, Kentucky. And it is easily reached. It's a place with a modest tour fee, and it's one in which it's interactive, that the people can meet and feed even some of the most famous horses of all times. This was started in 2003, and it was made because in many ways people were upset that when they heard the news that one of the Kentucky Derby winners, Ferdinand, had died in a slaughterhouse. And really, no animals should have to face that in the first place, but especially some of those which are so well known to the American public. And so a retirement facility is here, along with two satellites, one in New York and one in another portion of Kentucky. But here is the one that the most famous of the horses, such as Silver Charm. And this is one that people would really identify with and enjoy. And the animals enjoy having the people present too. Also, we're going to meet Michael Blowen, who runs this farm, and who was at one time the film critic of the Boston Globe, got very interested in horses, came to Kentucky, and is now working full-time with all his great enthusiasm to make this one of the great places to visit when you're here.
Someone is coming in, and one of the horses here.
Yes, sir.
Michael, you know so much about this area. Can you tell us a few things about this favorite horse that you've got here?
Oh, sure. Well, that's Silver Charm. He won the Kentucky Derby in 1997. He won the Preakness the same year. Okay. He got beaten at Belmont by a horse named Touch Gold. Oh. And Touch Gold is right over there.
So oh, my goodness.
Can I have my kiss?
Oh, no.
Thank you. Thank you. You're so handsome. Huh? The horses that we have here.
Can I touch him?
Yeah, please. He doesn't like to get petted, but he loves getting a carrot. So if you give him hold your hand out, give him a carrot. He'd love that. Yeah?
You don't like me petted.
No. For some reason, he's a little head shy. He doesn't mind giving you a kiss. Do you? You know, people told me you can't. He's getting a little rough. I'm starting to enjoy that more than I should. I've probably been living on this farm a little too long. How about
it? Huh? He wants some more carrots.
Yeah. Yeah, so when he after he won the big races in America, he went to Dubai, and he won the Dubai World Cup.
Oh, I see.
And when he retired, he was the wealthiest horse ever at that point.
And silver is his color, which is very unusual for a thoroughbred.
Yeah, when he raced, he was steel gray.
Oh, is that right? Yep.
Now, we get older, we get
a little aged, and he does too.
A little whiter and a little grayer, just like him. But One of the great stories about him is that when he did go to Japan as a breeding stallion, when his breeding career was over there, the owners in Japan agreed to send him back because Mr. Lewis, his original owner, had put together a foundation so that when it was time for him to retire, he could come back because it's an expensive proposition.
Oh, yeah.
And we were very lucky to have him. How about him?
Does he get along with other horses?
Well, the stallions don't. We keep the stallions separate.
I see. Okay.
The way I like to put it is that the stallions really like to have neighbors. Okay. They just don't want roommates.
That's well said.
Yeah,
that's interesting. They do want something, a horse near.
Yes, they do.
You've been involved with horses long before you started this project, I'm
yes.
sure.
But when I was growing up, I didn't think of anything about it. I just didn't. When I was a kid growing up in Connecticut, a Sports Illustrated would come in and the horses on the cover, I threw it away because I thought it was stupid to think of horses as athletes. And now after being around them, I realize that they're superior to their human counterparts.
Mm. We have a lot of tours, and it's a huge place. What, you got 400 or 500 acres? Or?
We have about just over 300, and we have 162 horses.
But it's a non-profit organization?
Yes, sir.
And you have to keep it with begging for money?
Or? Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Well,
we want to say that.
Yes, we beg for money.
Yeah.
Actually, it's the opposite now. I used to beg for money, but as soon as I stopped asking, I got more money. Because no matter what, they don't like it. Even if they like you, we have a sign over there, Bob Baffert, of course, who trains Justify, and Justify may be going, they get the Triple Crown. He's certainly going for the Triple Crown 2 weeks ago.
Oh, so he's a trainer.
Yeah, Bob's been here a bunch of times because he trained this horse. This is his
is
first
that
Derby
right?
winner.
This is a trained horse.
Yeah, and he had War Emblem. He was a, War Emblem was a Bob Baffert horse. He won the Derby and the Preakness.
Yeah.
Now we got, and Bob comes here all the time. But when he came here, he told me, he says, people should give money to old friends. It's not a scam. I have a sign over there that says, give money to old friends. It's not a scam, Bob Baffert.
I'll get a shot of that.
Good. Oh, my goodness. Well, that gets you some fun.
Well, so how was it that you started this specific thing?
Well,
I mean, you said
I was working at Suffolk Downs for a bottom of the barrel trainer. And that this is at the end of the line. The purse's structure couldn't support the sport, really. And not only at Suffolk Downs, but other racetracks throughout New England, but spare races, Northampton, Marshfield, Brockton, your Great Barrington, it just couldn't support it. And at the end of the day, if they couldn't win races at this level, these people essentially got stuck with them. And they were other people's cast-offs. You know what I mean? We had horses there that really were good at one time when they were four or five. And then by the time they got to be 9 or 10 and got injured and couldn't run so much anymore, they'd end up down there. Mm-hmm. And then your alternatives for what, when I first started doing it and horses would disappear, I'd say, oh, wow, this is good. And they go, yeah, we found a good home for that horse at a riding academy in Maine. Okay, nice. Well, it finally occurred to me there must be 10,000 riding academies in Maine and I've never seen one.
So. Yeah.
I figured that's not.
It's hard to imagine a racing horse trotting along a trail.
Yeah. Well,
maybe they would.
They do it now. They can do it now, but not on the scope that was necessary because trucks would show up every week and pick up 10 horses and just go right to the slaughterhouse.
Yeah.
And so I was falling in love with these horses. That were yes, that's right. In love with you. You know that, don't you? And he, I knew that. They deserve better. The more options you give horses in terms of making decisions, it seems the happier that they are. So when we built this barn, we built the back door so they can go out if they want or they can come in if they want. It's up to them. This is a horse named Bull Dior. It's a really, really nice horse. And he's in because he had a tumor on his hoof.
Oh.
And it's very rare. In fact, most of the veterinarians that I've talked to have never heard of him. He had it right on his hook.
Wow.
And so it was surgically removed, and he's doing really, really well now. And he should probably be going back out in another week or so.
And so that's why you leave some in?
Yes.
Yeah. This whole water, they all stay in.
No, they all stay out.
They all stay out.
In fact, it's funny because the only time we ever run into trouble with them is when it gets really hot, not when it gets cold.
Oh,
yeah.
You hardly ever lose horse in the winter.
That's the way with all horses.
You know? This is Nicanor. Hi, handsome.
He wasn't a great racehorse. He won a couple of races, but he's a full brother to Derby winner Barbara. And he loves carrots. It didn't take too long to figure out the carrot deal, does it? Huh? You're so nice. Huh? You're so nice.
You must have a whole team of, you have your, I forget, what's the name of the, they scrape out the hooves and
put barriers.
Your farriers, of course.
We're really lucky. Now, here's the really lucky part about this place, too. Our veterinarian is Dr. Brian Waldron. She's never sent us a new one. There's a place called the Park Equine Clinic that does surgery and is a medical. They've never sent us a new
one. That's great.
So when the horses come here, nobody has to worry about whether they're going to get the best health care or not, because the money won't stop us.
Sweet.
Whatever they need, they get. And it doesn't make any difference if they're 27 and never won a race, or they're 5 and are champions.
Mm.
The same deal all the way around. Right?
You're so handsome. You're so handsome.
Yeah, he's not going to hear you. He's hard to do
about it. He'll get used to it.
Joey, this is Joey P., one of the greatest of all New Jersey breds. Huh, Joey? Here to one of the million dollars. This is New Jersey. Hard to hear.
Oh, you kicked the other one open sometime.
Yeah.
Hey, kiddo.
We have to go through here, especially with the new horses. We're not sure how they're going to react to all the people.
Okay.
So we try to make it so that they feel comfortable and the people feel comfortable.
Yeah, for new
markets. Yes. Lubosch. He won the West Point Handicap twice at the Saratoga.
Oh, really?
He's relatively new. We've only had him for about 3 or 4 weeks.
Oh,
I think it was a little abrupt.
See, he's new, so everything's new to him.
Are you getting pictures?
Yeah.
Figured out.
That was a great tour.
It's Have you really ever had like a really psychologically troubled?
Oh yeah.
I mean, I guess
I still got one. War Emblem. He's
kind of like children.
There he is over there. He won the Derby in 2002. He's got all his fans over there now. And he won the Preakness the same year. And he's a complete narcissist.
Is that right?
It's only one way to do things, his way, period. Period. He has no use for anything else except himself. He adores himself and nothing else. You could give him a carrot, and he won't take orders. He will not take orders. In fact, he won the Derby, he won the Preakness, he lost the Belmont to a horse we have down there named Sarava. And then he came back and he won the Haskell Stakes up in New Jersey. I mean, he was just skyrocketing.
So he had a double win.
After that race, he decided, I don't have to do this anymore if I don't want to. And he stopped.
Oh, so he stopped performing?
He stopped racing. He wouldn't even go out to the track for a workout.
Okay.
I was often wondered, and some of them are like that.
Yes.
I always thought every horse would do it, but I guess
no.
Well, actually,
some
I thought it was
never
totally
do it. Some of them do it sometimes. But Wayne Lucas came here after Charismatic came home. He came to see Charismatic. We were talking, and I told him Bob's story about Warren Bull quitting. He goes, a lot of my good horses quit. Winning Colors won the Derby. She quit. She just said, wait a minute. There's a little guy in my back with a stick.
Yeah.
And I'm supposed to go around in a circle. Everybody screams and yells. And then I get to go back to my stall.
And they just don't do it.
They stop doing it.
It looks like you have a pretty dedicated volunteer corps. People who really love their horses.
Yeah.
Now, a friend of mine's sister's out in, Central Kentucky, but she's got rescue horses. I mean, I suppose that's just maybe not big winners or big runners.
I don't know. I always say the horses rescued me.
Oh, well, that's... that seems...
I know Francois
Chabot. Oh, I love that. Alors, vous avez ici le fond d'abord de la femme Old Friend.
The founder, Michael Blowen. He's paying attention to the horse, Nick and Nor.
Nick and Nor.
And I think we just scared him.
Thank you.
Hello there, it's not a carrot, unfortunately. It's just a camera.
We have met Michael Bluen here at Old Friends, and it's so good to see how much they love the horses, the volunteers, the people who come, everyone. This is an introduction. We invite you too to come and see a beautiful place for the older horses. This is Al Fritsch, earthhealing.info. Come and see us sometime.